With that, I'd like to start the meeting off with, where the hell is it? Oh, quorum and call to order. I guess I'll go ahead and just do a roll call vote, roll call piece. Member Doherty, thank you.
Here.
Member O'Brien?
Here.
Member Hansen?
Here.
Member Wachowski?
Here.
Member Green?
Here.
Member Vail?
Here.
Chair Myers is also present. With that, we'd like to have a moment of silence. All right, thank you. Member O'Brien, if you would lead us off in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Next up is we'll do the board member announcements. I guess we'll start with the member Gene Dowdy.
Good evening, board members. Looks like winter is over with and spring is here. There's been a couple boats broke loose with all the winter storms there. Mostly it's the pennant lines that have been breaking on them. So now's the time to check your pennant lines. I was out on a boat this morning where the pennant lines were inch and a half thick, and they had just completely worn through. So fortunately, the Harbor Department was able to take the boat and put it over on one of their impound moorings, the guest moorings. But it's time to check your moorings and your slips. And then I have here, I'm going to pass down what's holding our docks together. As you all know, they're getting old and worn out. And this is a copy of one of the bolts. They just rust away. They're like stalactites. And then inside of here, there's also some little screws. That's what's holding the pontoons to the floats. There's just nothing there. So as you can see, things wear out. So it's time to get some money to fix those things up. So okay, that's it. That's all I got.
All right, thank you, Gene. Member O'Brien.
Yes, good evening. Thank you very much. As far as the commercial fishing goes, this week, Department of Fish and Wildlife announced that there would be no salmon season this year. And that during the same week here, they closed what's left of the crab season. So this is going to have an incredibly severe effect, not just here in Morro Bay, but on the entire West Coast. These two fisheries are two of our mainstays, and without them, the fishermen up and down the coast will be scrambling to find something else to fish in. So what happens now is the fisherman has to decide what he can do, what he can do for a living. So he's got to find a way to make some money. It's going to be really tough on a lot of guys this year, a lot of crew. A lot of people forget all the crewmen are involved in this too. But salmon and crab are going to be shut down. The 15th of this month, the crab will be discontinued, and the salmon will not start on May 1st and will not open. So, then, in the good news, the museum is painting the sub. And the sub is on loan to the museum from the Department of the Navy. And painting it is quite a project because it has to go by all of their rules, regulations, all of their paint. The paint has to all be the same colors, so forth and so on. So we've got a fellow doing it who's got an extremely good reputation, has done boats in this port before and boats up and down the coast. He's very good, and we're glad to have him here. He's down from Oregon. So that should be completed hopefully in the next 2 months. That's about it. Thank you very much.
Jeremiah, I've got a question. A lot of our commercial flips rely on fish tickets to establish their use. How is that going to affect? I assume it's going to affect our fish ticket sales.
Yeah, thanks, Gene. It does. And that will be one of the problems everybody will have to deal with, of course. Here in town, we do have a dispensation for a year for somebody who doesn't accumulate enough fish tickets to qualify. So they are dispensation for 1 year. And
we'll just have to be a consideration of that, yes.
This probably will. I imagine if we bring it before the city council, I would think, and they have done in the past, they'll give a further dispensation. But what I'm hoping myself is that people start fishing for rock cod again, which there's not much market, consequently not much price, because the market's been gone. We've lost the market 20 years ago when they closed the rock cod conservation area. But this is a perfect opportunity to begin to bring the sales of that fish up again and put it on the table again. Thank you.
Harbor Director, do you have any comment on anything we need to do or just keep an eye on it?
What was that, Kim?
I was asking Ted if there was anything that you want to get in front of with that topic.
I'm aware of it. In fact, I think Congressman Carbajal is discussing it tomorrow in a meeting is what I heard. And then there's going to be a larger follow-up meeting. I think it has more to do with not being able to stop it, but, again, mitigation of some sort. So I don't know exactly what's going to come from that. But I think from the harbor's perspective, whatever support you need for those vessels that can't produce fish tickets, we're absolutely going to support. So,
thank you very much, Ted. Appreciate that for sure. And I'm sure all of those fellows who are going to find, men and women who are going to find themselves in need of that, will be very grateful.
Thank you. Anything else, Gene? Or Jeremiah? Sorry, I'm a little brain bait. Board member Hanson.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. I'm just so happy that the sun is out. It has been a long three months of rain. April is a really active month for the Chamber of Commerce, so I wanted to throw out a couple dates and fun things for the community to get involved with. On April 12th, there's going to be a mixer at the Great American Fish Company, 1185 Embarcadero, at 5:30 to 7, free food, and just kind of get to know your business down here on the waterfront. The Chamber Gala is April 21st, 2023, called Morro Bay in Wonderland. There's great silent auction items, and there's tributes to amazing Morro Bay citizens and businesses that have contributed greatly to our lovely little town, especially the waterfront. April 19th, Breakfast on the Bay, great thing to be a part of, to get to know about current events and other businesses that are in your town, 7:30 a.m. to 9. And then they're going to do a shop, sip, and stroll again on the downtown for April 13th, and you check in at Baby Dudes at 307 Morro Bay Boulevard. That's for me.
Thank you, Chairperson Hanson. Chairperson Vail.
Sure. Thank you, Jeremiah. So I won't talk about the museum. But if you get a chance to go down the Embarcadero, it's now been, the submarine has been tented. It was quite a spectacular effort to take shrink wrap and tie the whole thing down. I'm adding it to my resume because I don't think very many people can say they've helped shrink wrap a submarine. and it just seems appropriate. Also with the museum, we've got the San Salvador, replica of the San Salvador coming in August, which is going to be a multi-thousand guest opportunity to see an authentic square rigger. And other than that, it's been very busy. My feed barn blew down and a tree blew down on the fence of my horse arena, and then another tree fell down on my pipe corrals and turned one of them into a metal sculpture. So I've been busy trying to fix things. That's it for now.
All right. Thank you, Member Bell. Member Green?
I have two items. One, there is an informational meeting about the Ironman race, which takes place in late, so the race itself takes place in late May. On April 20th, from 5:30 to 7:30 in the community center, there's an informational meeting. There was one that I actually didn't know about that already happened in May, but there's going to be a follow-up informational meeting that's an opportunity for anyone in the community, residents, businesses, to see how traffic's going to flow, what parking situations are looking like, what opportunities there might be to participate in Ironman. And that takes place, again, April 20th from 5:30 to 7:30 in the Morro Bay Community Center. The other item, I just saw this posted. There's on April 11th of next week, there's a city council closed session to discuss extremely important items. So if the public would like to chime in regarding the future of any of these four properties, 801 Embarcadero, 833 Embarcadero, 495 Embarcadero, and 781 Market Avenue, which is the Market Plaza property, please chime in via public correspondence or make your way to speak in person if you want to have a sort of a say in the future of those properties. Of particular note, the three Embarcadero properties are key locations and an essential part of a successful Harbor Enterprise Fund. And as of the 2018 numbers, all three combined for roughly 6% of the Harbor Enterprise Fund annual rent. So chime in. Again, that's April 11th for City Council closed session if interested. Thank you.
Thank you, Member Green. Member Matowski.
Yeah. A few things. On May 4th, there will be an offshore wind energy event with Senator Laird at the Morro Bay High School. If you just search offshore wind and Senator Laird, you'll be able to find tickets to that. Also, summer's coming up, and Morro Bay is a great place to be a kid. Unfortunately, junior lifeguards is full, which is also fortunate because that's our pipeline for future Morro Bay beach lifeguards. But Morro Bay Little Guards, I think, still has spaces, and the Morro Bay Yacht Club will be announcing their summer sailing sessions for kids soon. Also, if you're a parent looking for summer activities for kids in Morro Bay, the Morro Bay Art Center will be publishing summer classes for kids.
Thank you, Member Blatowski. I just have a single festival, kite festival, coming up in the latter part of April. It's 28th through the 30th, so it'll be a lot of kites flying down by Coleman Park. Should be pretty cool, and a lot of competition. That concludes. Any other comments for the member announcements? Nope. Now we'll move over to the presentation. Now, Laura, if you want to tee up the PowerPoint. And welcome. We'd like to welcome Gina Bentall, senior scientist at the Sea Otter Savvy organization, I guess. Mm-hmm. Welcome, and we'll go ahead and get started once you're ready.
Thanks. Yeah, so hopefully I'll be able to see my slides on one of these screens.
Yeah, it's coming up. It just takes a minute.
Super. So. Yeah, so my name's Jenna Bentall, and I'm director and senior scientist at Sea Otter Savvy. And just going to tell you a little bit about myself before I get started. So Sea Otter Savvy was founded in 2015. I was the founder, and it was founded as part of a collaborative multi-agency effort to address the problem of human-caused disturbance to sea otters. And prior to that starting, I was a full-time Seattle research biologist for 13 years, and I worked for UC Santa Cruz, for USGS, for the Monterey Bay Aquarium, basically full-time, doing pretty much nothing else but watching wild tagged sea otters all day long and collecting data about what they're doing, where they're going for various research projects. So that's my background before I came into Sea Otter Savvy and turned everything completely around to a whole new adventure that's still research but a good chunk of outreach. Uh-oh.
While we're waiting for the slides to come up, I just have a quick question. Sure. I know there's some volunteer work for people that are kayak to help keep people away from the otters. Are you associated with that, or is that?
We're not Sea Life Stewards. We do have a volunteer program, but it's shore based. It's gotcha. Not the kayak okay. based. So Sea Life Stewards is a California State Parks program.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, but we do the sea otter training for them.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. Slides are up.
Awesome.
Yeah, the laptop's over there. Although Lori may be page down monitor.
Yeah. It's on, yes, but I think it may not extend far enough.
May not be synced.
Yeah, it's okay. You want to? Yeah. So just a little bit about Sea Otter Savvy. As I mentioned, so we're a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we're advised by the agencies shown here, so California Department of Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and USGS, which conducts the bulk of research, sea otter research, in the state of California and in Alaska. And go ahead and hit next. Defenders of Wildlife also participates among our advisors. Go ahead. As I mentioned, we do research and education. I am really not going to be talking much about our outreach and education program. I'm going to talk a little bit about our research because I'm showing you some figures that are based on research that we do, so I want to talk a little bit about how that's done, but I don't have enough time to talk about the whole program. If anyone has any questions, I can fill you in on some of the outreach work we do. Go ahead. We really focus on fostering community stewardship. So if my grand plan worked out perfectly, my job would be irrelevant after a number of years, and the communities where sea otters live would really be the ones mostly involved in taking care of them and conserving them and protecting them and acting as stewards for them. So I'm really just trying to guide communities to work together, and our research just provides the foundation of information to help them understand some of the human impacts to sea otters. Go ahead. And we really are very partnership focused. We're a small organization. We have only 2 staff and pretty small budget, and we try to extend our reach by 4 main partnerships and collaborating with other agencies and other organizations that maybe work on other species or have a different or broader reach. So we really do a lot of collaboration and partnerships. Okay? And we really focus on science and issue-based social media, so there's a lot of information on the internet about sea otters. I would venture to say a majority of it is incorrect or what I refer to as fact adjacent. And we really try to, in our social media and our outreach, only provide information that we know is based on actual sea otter science. Okay? So this is just, you can go ahead and click and play this video. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about sea otter disturbance. And if it doesn't play, that's all right. It's sometimes helpful. People don't understand what I'm talking about when I'm talking about human-caused disturbance to sea otters. Yeah, go ahead and go back. We can just look at that. So what I'm talking about is, for the most part, what we focus on is human marine recreation activities, usually getting too close to where sea otters are resting and causing them to wake up and dive and swim away. So that in that video, that was just a little small private boat that had stopped to take a look at sea otters and had just been drifting. And one of the things people often aren't aware of is their drift. And as they drifted into the raft, the entire raft of once resting otters will dive and swim away. So group vigilance is part of why sea otters raft together. So in order for that to work for them, against predators, that they have to play by the rules, and the rules are that if one of the otters in the group gets startled, then the rest of the raft will dive. And then it usually takes them about 15 minutes to regroom their fur and get back to rest. And if that only happened once a day or once a week, probably wouldn't be a big deal, but based on our data across all of our study sites along the Central Coast, disturbance happens about, on average, 6 times a day. So that means that's within the daylight period because we can't observe at night. And that's average. So there's some sites with less and there's some sites with more. Okay, so now I'm going to show you, I think you can just go ahead and click, but I'm going to talk a little bit about why sea otters are particularly vulnerable to human disturbance. So first of all, they're a recovering species. So hopefully you are all aware that in the 1700s and 1800s, sea otters were nearly extirpated due to the maritime fur trade, and they were reduced from hundreds of thousands down to just a couple thousand in separated remnant populations in really, really rugged places where people just couldn't get with their boats. And for all the otters that are living in the world today, all the sea otters are descended from those remnant populations that were fragmented. And so they're all kind of growing together. And that has relevance in a couple ways. One, they're protected species now, so they're listed under the Endangered Species Act as threatened. They're protected as marine mammals under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and they're still recovering their range. And during the time that they're recovering, that coastline has changed significantly. So there's a lot of human development. There's a lot of activities, fisheries, coastal development, recreation, all kinds of things that have sprung up on the coastline in their absence. And so as they recover, we're sort of dealing with how that coexistence will look as sea otters come into a place that's significantly changed from the one they were nearly extirpated from, and where the humans have really gotten used to kind of having things a certain way in the absence of this really significant actor in the coastal ecosystem. And also the one final thing on the recovery is that without that that near extirpation event, we really wouldn't understand their impact on the ecosystem, because that absence and presence, fragmented presence, allowed scientists to look at places with and without sea otters that were essentially the same ecosystem and compare them to each other and really see how important sea otters are to stable kelp forest ecosystem habitats. Okay, go ahead. Charismatic, so we all know they're very popular with the public. They're very attractive animals. They tend to make lots of funny faces. I actually don't use the C word when describing them. That's C-U-T-E, because I there's a lot of other interesting things in my mind about sea otters, but I don't mind if other people use it. It's undeniable in a lot of ways. Unfortunately, it does draw people to want to get close to them. They like them. They think they're cuddly. They think they're very friendly and want to be petted, and so people tend to get a little closer than they should. And go ahead and hit the next one. And that kind of goes hand in hand with their accessibility. It's a nearshore species. They live in places often overlapping with places where humans live or recreate or make their living. And so they're very much overlapped with people, and that causes the charismatic thing to be extra powerful. Next one. And their physiology is unique among marine mammals. They don't have the blubber layer that every other marine mammal has. That has two functions. It both insulates them from the cold water, and it is an energy storage. So sea otters don't store energy well. They live paycheck to paycheck. So every day they're just getting in enough calories for them to survive. And so they don't, every time they have to engage in an activity that uses energy that's outside of their regular activity budget, they can either lose body condition or they have to go out and find more food in order to make up for that energy deficit. So that's kind of where the disturbance part comes in. So you can go ahead and hit the next one. And then human behavior is really hard to control. So one of my biggest challenge with my job is that I'm really trying to encourage people to change their behavior and change their attitude about wildlife. And I think if there's one thing we've learned since the pandemic, it's really, really, really hard to change people's behavior. And so we want to not just be telling people this is what you should do. We want them to want to behave differently. And there really are some very simple things that I'm not going to really talk about here today that people can do to avoid causing disturbance. So it's really, and we're trying to really change how we think about human-wildlife interactions in terms of not just always wildlife management, but also as a human behavior and psychology issue as well. So it's not always just having to deal with the wildlife, it's also incorporating human behavior into that mix so that we can have a long-term sustainable coexistence. So go ahead. So all these things together create a pretty strong disturbance effect for sea otters and is why that I'm here running a program that really specifically addresses this issue. Go ahead. So I just clicked on that one because we're going to come back and talk to that, talk about that physiology and that unique vulnerability of sea otters as it relates to Morro Bay in a future slide. Go ahead. So here's just more information about that whole energy balance. So their energy in is only in the form of the prey that they eat. That's the only way they're getting energy in. And they have to dive down to the bottom, get that food off the bottom, find it, get it, bring it up to the surface, and process it. So even that course of finding food is using up energy for them. And then they use that behavior, that energy, to groom themselves, to take care of their pups, to swim from foraging areas to resting areas. If they're males, they have to patrol their territory. All those things are normal behaviors. That's what they need that energy for. Go ahead and click. And they really, really need rest. And I'm sure you guys can all relate. Everyone can relate to how important rest is. And if you don't feel rested, that you don't feel great. And in the long term, if you're losing rest, that can have long-term health impacts. Go ahead and click. So repeated disturbance to their rest time is costly. So not only is it interrupting that rest period, but it's also costing them more energy that they have to either make up by eating more or they'll lose body condition really fast. And paycheck to paycheck is the analogy that I use. Most people can relate to that. I know sea otter biologists can relate to that. So every day they're basically using up their entire paycheck of energy, and then they have to bring that in again the next day. So one of the internet facts that you often hear is sea otters need to eat a quarter of their body weight every day, and that actually is true. So a 100-pound sea otter would have to eat 25 pounds of food a day, or that would be a human equivalent of 100 Big Macs. So it's a lot of food, and that's really why they have such a strong impact on their environment, because they have to eat quite a lot. Go ahead. So I want you to think about when you're out on the bay. So sorry to bum everybody out, but I'm trying to give a reality check. I gotta work against the whole cute profile to give everyone a little reality check about sea otters. When you're watching the females, so it's mostly females here in Morro Bay, when you're watching them, just have a look for them. You can see this female's ribs right here. So this body condition is normal for center of the range, central coast adult females that are in a reproductive state. So they put even more energy. That 25% of their body weight goes up to 50% when they're rearing a pup. They're making milk to feed their pup, and they're also giving part of the prey that they forage to their pup. By the time that pup is weaned after 6 months, it's a very, very tricky time for them, and they can succumb. That's the time when females are most likely to die. And recent work done on this particular syndrome in females having recently weaned pups showed that 56% of female sea otters that stranded dead had this emaciation problem. So this is a significant issue for survival for female sea otters. So I always tell people, when you watch an otter dive down, and the one in the circle there, look for that backbone and those ribs showing, and that'll just remind you these are not just cute, fluffy, chubby little otters. These are animals that are struggling for survival. Next. Just to show you where we work, I think you can hit it again here. So Sea Otter Savvy operates on the whole central coast. So pretty much within this area, it's a little bit smaller than the range of the southern sea otter in California, but it's where there's a lot of overlap between urban areas and sea otter habitat. And so we work all within that area, and we're based, my office is up in Moss Landing, but I come down to Morro Bay every month. Go ahead. So let's talk a little bit about sea otters in Morro Bay. So Morro Bay, as you all know, is a really unique place. Kind of has an interesting story, history with sea otters. And it's a wetland. It's an estuary. And It's really, the otter number of otters that we're seeing here in the bay is really fairly recent, and it's one of only two. It's really the only the second wetlands estuary system in California that sea otters have colonized. So up north we have Elkhorn Slough, where we've learned a lot about how sea otters interact in that ecosystem, and now Morro Bay. They're starting to move further back from the harbor into the back part of the bay and the estuary. So go ahead. So this is a pretty simple figure. Sorry, this is the simplest one I'm going to show you. So on the bottom, the x-axis, we just have a years. And then on the y, or the vertical axis, we have count, just raw counts of sea otters. And you can see back in the 80s, there was a peak in population in Morro Bay, and those were almost entirely, probably entirely males. So that was probably a bachelor group that tends to be on the range periphery as that range was kind of moving, marching down the coastline and expanding to the south. And then it was really just a handful of otters, less than five for a long, long time. And then around 2010, you can see that the number climbed pretty quickly, and I actually did a count just this morning, and it was 45 adults and 9 pups, which is what we've been seeing pretty typically in Morro Bay. But that's a pretty good chunk of otters and a pretty significant change. And so the community of Morro Bay is having to adapt to one or two otters over decades to 45 otters just in the last, what is it, 2023, 13 years. Go ahead. So we do, Sea Otter Savvy does monthly Morro Bay surveys. So we have teams of volunteers. I often go out with them, and we go out on a boat and count all the sea otters we see. I don't know how well you guys can see that map, but you can kind of see that there's some clustering areas. This is throughout all of those counts, and so this isn't just one count or even one season. This is just showing where the main clusters are. And so over there by Target Rock, you can see there's a lot of clustering there. There's another cluster that's just stacked one on top of the other. Oh, I should explain, the larger circles are larger groups. Smaller circles and dots are just individuals. And they're all stacked up at the South T Pier because that raft is always right in the same place. And then we're seeing some otters resting in the eelgrass beds at low tide off of the Sandspit, so Sandals Cove. And we're seeing more rafts off tidelands and in the Back Bay. So we had, today we had about 34 otters tidelands north and about, 34, so 11 otters in the Back Bay and tidelands south. So there are more otters using that Back Bay area, and we're not really able to see in the back channels, so we can't say really if anybody's going back in there, but it's definitely changing. And so we're looking really, really closely at both this, these short-term seasonal changes in where they go and also this long-term shift in how they're using that Back Bay, because it's so important to our understanding of how they use estuaries. I think, does anybody, well, I'll wait for questions. Go ahead. Population growth. Oh, let's go ahead and hit, I was trying to remember what this slide was. Go ahead and hit next. So here you can see, this is just slightly out of date by a couple years, but you can see the blue line, just ignore the pups for now. The dark blue line is just showing the growth of the sea otter population inside Morro Bay. And you notice I'm showing all of Estero Bay with Little Morro Bay down here. Go ahead and hit next. You can see that there's almost a perfect match of a decline in otters in Estero Bay that coincides, overlaps with that same timing of them coming in to Morro Bay. And so I can't say anything definitively about this, but one thing I will say is the Estero Bay open water is one of the shark predation hotspots for sea otters, and we're less likely to have sea otter predation inside Morro Bay. So this may be one of the reasons why this group came in. Go ahead. So I'm going to go back to this slide. So just a reminder, you can just keep clicking through this. So they're recovering species. They're charismatic, they have a publicity problem, they're accessible to humans, they're uniquely vulnerable. So I changed the physiology to vulnerability, and then we have human behavior in the mix, and that all leads to disturbance. So just to recap, let's go ahead and click to the next one. So now on top of those things, I just want to just share with you some of the other threats that they face. And disturbance itself is not likely to be a life-threatening issue for them acutely, but these are some issues that they face that are unique not unique to Morro Bay, but are prevalent in Morro Bay. And the larger the arrow is, the stronger that effect is. And one of the things I forgot to mention is that sea otters are a local species. They show a high degree of site fidelity, which means they have a home range and they stay in that home range for most of their life. They settle down and they're really in, you know, just a stretch of tens of kilometers, or even a male may have just like a 1 kilometer squared home range. And so things that happen locally affect sea otters locally. So what affects them at a population level may not be relevant at a local level, and vice versa. So these, I'm talking specifically, I'm talking about things that may affect them throughout their California range, but in the context of Morro Bay, if that makes sense. So shark attack is the biggest threat, no question. So if you talk with Mike Harris from CDFW, he's always telling you about some 2 or 3 otters he picked up, and they were usually shark bit. So about over 50% of otters that are given a known cause of death, it's attributed to shark bites. And it's a non-predatory event. They bite them. It's an exploratory bite to see if they're yummy and delicious like a seal. They're not. They're hairy and lean, and they don't eat them, but the otter's going to die from that wound. So that's a very significant cause of death. You guys have an additional concern here in Morro Bay. That's disease, specifically protozoal encephalitis related to 2 land-based parasites. This is kind of new, I think, within the last 2 decades in marine species. This is Toxoplasma and Sarcocystis. And they are based in cats, felids, wild and domestic is toxo, and opossums is sarco, and they tend to get into the ocean by via runoff. So if we have big rain events, like we may have had this year, they tend to be more prevalent. So we really don't know what's going to happen. There's a lot of concerns about these diseases becoming really prevalent in Morro Bay, and there have been some pretty extreme sea otter mortality events related to these. Both of these diseases humans can get as well, so it's also an indicator if sea otters start getting sick. They're getting sick from the prey, the food that they're eating, that are accumulating, the organism, which are clams and a few other species, and humans eat those too. Also, the little pink eye that I have shown there, that's coccidiomycosis, that's a fungal valley fever. So that's also showing up in sea otters in Morro Bay, and that's a human contagion. That's a fungus. So those are kind of scary critters, and there's a particularly virulent form of toxo that's been found in sea otters in 2022, and we don't know to what extent that's going to be showing up in 2023 yet. So then I have HABs, harmful algal blooms. So those result in toxins that can get into sea otters the same way as the pathogens. Spills aren't such a problem here, but they're more of a threat. So an oil spill or just a fuel spill inside the harbor has not really been a threat to sea otters, but it's something that looms on the surface. And because of their fur coat insulation and their manner of grooming their coat, if a spill happens, it could devastate a population. And then finally, I put in entanglement, and would include maybe boat strikes in there. We don't know a lot about the mortality of entanglement. We know we do see fishing line entanglement pretty frequently, but it's hard to attribute it to death because often we'll get a report. Mike will go out, look for that otter. He'll find it, but they won't be able to catch them and bring them in and see what damage is done, and then they can't find them again. So we don't know a lot about the mortality, but we know there's a high rate of entanglement. Okay, and then disturbance comes in on all of those other stressors, right? So they have the food stress. They may have disease stress. They may be have a predator issue that keeps them from leaving the bay or encourages them to stay in the bay. All these other things are pressures on them, and then the disturbance comes in. It's just that extra thing. Disturbance is something we can do something about, which is nice because all these other things are really, really hard to do things about. Next. So this is a really nasty-looking figure. So we do have a community science team, so almost all of our research is done by volunteers. There's a couple of our longtime volunteers and some Cal Poly students working down in Port San Luis. We have seven study sites all along the Central Coast, and they go out to each of the sites once a week and collect data, and we've been doing that for 7 years now. And what you're seeing here, I'm not going to go into too much detail because it's really kind of complicated, but this is just showing, based on all the data that we've collected over all those years, the computer model is saying, I'm looking at all of your data, and I'm saying this is what impact disturbance has on a typical day. So it's just deriving that typical day from many thousands of iterations looking at this full data set. And that's about all I'm going to say about it. What you can see is that the blue line on the top graph, that is showing activity when what we call stimuli are present, so like kayakers for the most part, other boaters. And the red line is just normal with no stimuli present. The space between that blue line and the red line is the extra energy that it takes for that. And then that's represented in the middle graph. And then what happens, remember I talked about multiple times per day, you get this cumulative effect. That's the bottom graph. It's just saying throughout that day, that cost of energy goes up and up and up and up and up until the end of the day. It's their big deficit, their big like you have to get your car fixed payment that hits your budget unexpectedly. Next. We also do work with Cal Poly students with Dr. Lisa Needles. They collect foraging data, so they have an ongoing sort of self-sustaining project where they train each other how to watch what sea otters inside Morro Bay are eating, and we're especially interested in learning what they're eating, not just in the bay, but in the back bays. They're starting to use that habitat. So what is most interesting from this figure here, you can kind of see they eat a lot of bivalves. Maybe no one's surprised. So bivalves, it's mostly clams, mostly gaper clams. But what's interesting, if you see decapods, that's the 1, 2, 3, 4th one over, and the blue line there, that's the back bay. So in the back bay, they're mostly eating crabs, and nowhere else is comparable in terms of the number of crabs that they're eating. So it's pretty interesting that they're eating mostly Metacarcinus gracilis, small, graceful cancer crabs. Next. So I don't think this, just see if it'll play. I don't think it's going to play. Oh, try clicking that one. Yes. Doesn't have any sound, but this was made by Cal Poly students. It's just a cute little video project that some media students made for us. That was our sea otter costume. Okay, next. So just here's some more information. You can go to our website. Our website's really great. Shout out me. And you can learn lots of different things. There's lots of different tabs. And you can take the Sea Otter Savvy Pledge. You can tell others to take the pledge. They get some. If you take the pledge, you get some little digital media cards. When we do in-person outreach, we actually have stickers that people get when they take the pledge. And tag us, watch us on social media. And go ahead and hit next. Just a shout out to our advisors again and to our funding support and project partners. And then I know that I didn't have very many cute otter pictures, so next, there you go. That's right here in Morro Bay.
All right, you can't say that's not cute.
Yeah, I'll let you guys do it. It's charismatic. No,
charismatic.
No
Thank
doubt.
You very much. Any questions for Gina?
Yeah, do you work through the Department of Fish and Game or the state?
So we are in.
Who do you answer to?
I answer to me, which is my favorite thing. So their advisors. They are technical advisors to our program, and they give us a lot of help when we were first starting out and just developing the program. But we are a nonprofit, and I basically can do the beauty of running your own nonprofit is that you really don't answer to anyone. So, yeah, they can give us advice, but we pretty much are on our own in terms of the decisions we make.
I see. Thank you.
Thanks.
Any other questions?
I'm good.
I have a question. As it pertains to Morro Bay, are there any policies in place or enforcement issues or opportunities that might pertain to like harbor staff or anything dealing with like human disturbance or entanglements or anything like that?
So I have to give a shout out to the Morro Bay Harbor, and I'm really not just trying to like butter you up or anything, but we work with a lot of harbor departments, and the Morro Bay Harbor is just so far up here in terms of addressing wildlife issues that they make everybody else look difficult. So the harbor is great. I couldn't ask for anything better. We work with Becca all the time, and they're super responsive. So I think it just all depends in terms of sea otter or disturbance issues. It just depends on their availability and the timing. If they're available to respond to something, they might. But they don't have the power so much to enforce the wildlife issues. I think they can talk to people. But, yeah, in terms of actual enforcement from CDFW wardens, it's really rough for sea otter harassment. They usually have to be able to witness what's happening. There's very few of them, and they're very spread very thin. But people can make CalTIP reports especially if it has a media with it, and that does get recorded. So I always recommend that people make a disturbance report with CalTIP if they see something. This happens, like I said, six times a day is the average. So there's absolutely no way, and this is really why we formed this outreach program. There's no way to address it at an enforcement level with any amount of effectiveness. And the whole program is really founded on the belief that most people that are causing disturbance aren't doing it intentionally, that they just don't understand. I just watched someone today that I could tell thought they were doing it right, and they're getting it all wrong, but I know they're earnest. And so it's just a little bit of education for the most part, and there's always still going to be bad actors in any situation, but I think most people like sea otters and don't want to harm them.
Well, thank you.
Hi. So with Monterey Bay, I know that they released some otters to our area after recovery. Do you have any updates as far as how they're acclimating within Morro Bay? Are they still here? How many?
So I don't have a super great update. So that's done by the Monterey Bay Aquarium and, of course, in cooperation with CDFW and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And these are surrogate reared otters. So these are pups that were found separated from their mom and were not able to be reunited. And since you guys have Mike, who's like the rock star of the Sea Otter Reunite here in Morro Bay, you know what I mean by a reunite. So those otters go to the Monterey Bay Aquarium, where they have this unique surrogacy program where they're actually in part reared by female sea otters that take them on like their pups. So there have been some releases in Morro Bay. It's of a special interest because of this whole wetlands estuary ecosystem and seeing if otters kind of stay where they're put. And so far, the majority that have been put have not stayed. There's a few. So I think there's two remaining. And Mike keeps pretty good track of them, and others have just left the bay. There was one that interacted with one of the territorial males, which is always dangerous, and he didn't make it, and then others left the bay and were considered, you know, didn't reside within. So it's pretty tricky. It's still an evolving science with the best timing and grouping and age, class, and all of that is to have otters stay where they're released. Does that answer your question?
There's no further questions.
Okay.
We really appreciate your time. It was very informative, and thank you very much.
Oh, you have the thing. Okay. Thanks so much.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we'd like to go ahead and open it for public comment. If there's anybody in the audience that would like to speak on business matters that are on the agenda, you can do so at this time. If you're unable to start, come on up, sir.
Hi, I'm back again, Chuck Lostness. And, you know, I'm politicking or whatever. We need a shipyard in Morro Bay. And we had an incident on Monday where one of the transient boats on a Morro Bay Yacht Club mooring, their mooring line parted. And during the middle of that high wind storm, there was another boater next to them, saw what was going on, got in touch with our excellent harbor department. They were there within about 10 minutes and were able to successfully move that boat to the public dock down at Tidelands. I've talked with the guy on the phone, and I spoke with him today, and there is some damage to the bottom of his boat. He cannot haul in in Morro Bay, and he's leaving tonight to hopefully get to Monterey where they're going to haul him out. If we had a shipyard with adequate facilities, that would be something that he could have taken care of here rather than running the risk of going over 100 miles up the coast. And, of course, I don't think it's that expensive for us to have a shipyard here with the use of hydraulic trailers like I've talked about in the past. We don't need a travel lift. There's no infrastructure that the city would have to put in. We just have to put out feelers to these different companies and see what shows up about people who may want to start doing a shipyard business here. And, of course, some of you have heard my story, and others haven't, but I was down in Mexico for 7 years, and 3 of those years my boat was hauled at a shipyard that used hydraulic trailers. And, of course, my boat's just a typical 40-foot sailboat, no big deal, but I watched them haul out an 80,000-pound boat one time. It was a big ferro-cement monster. And those trailers, from what I understand, go up well over 100 tons, and the common size is 40 to 50 tons that most people use. So, and the ramp that we have is pretty much adequate to pull a boat out on one of these hydraulic trailers. So I'm just saying we need to do something. I don't know how we get there, what the next step is. Do we send out flyers to some of these companies? I mean, there's a company in Napa that already uses hydraulic trailers. They may have sufficient equipment that they could start another shipyard down here. I don't know. I don't think it's appropriate. I go talk to them about, hey, but bring a business down here if there's no hope for them to ever get anything. And I really want to thank our excellent harbor department for getting to the aid of that boat on Monday. They were there within 10 minutes, from what I'm told, and were able to successfully get that boat off the rocks. So, anyway, that's all I've got to say.
All right. Thank you, Chuck. Appreciate it. I know Councilperson Landrum wants to speak at this, or no? Okay, spoken out from yesterday. Okay, thanks. Next up is the consent calendar. We have 3 items: the 2 meeting minutes from previous meetings, October, December, and then the staff report. Anybody want to pull that, or just approve as is?
I motion that we approve as is.
Sure.
Second.
Go ahead. I guess we'll do a quick vote. We'll, Mary, dear Lori, I can just do this. You don't have to call. Okay. Watowski, are you okay with that?
Yes.
Approve the consent agenda as is. Nothing you want to pull?
Yes.
Green?
Yeah.
Yes.
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 Daddy, yes. Approved. All right. We'll go on to, I don't know, Ted, if you wanted to talk about the status report a little bit. I know we chatted briefly about that and some of the goal stuff before we get into business item B1. Yeah. I was thinking more along the lines of some of the goal stuff that we were chatting about prior to this meeting and that the council discussed last night.
I'm going to actually cover that in my oral report.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. So the first item on the agenda then is B1, which is the lease management policy.
Yeah. So Chair Myers and committee members, Ted Chaffone, Harbor Director. We are recommending is that you create and assign an ad hoc committee to look at the harbor lease policy as it relates to consent of landowners that, which is a legal document that requires a leaseholder to meet certain conditions while they're redeveloping their property. The issue that has come up is on occasion, for different reasons, the deadlines are missed. And when that happens, there's expense that's associated with that, not only to the harbor for getting a reapproval of a consent and extending it, but actually in the lost lease time of having an actual lease in place. So under council direction, we have been asked to ask the Harbor and Advisory Board to look at a way to compensate the harbor, the city, for that process. So if you would look at the lease policy and look at the way consent of landowner process works and see if you can come up with a recommendation on how we should then present back to council more of a standard. We're going to apply this in the interim, and we just want to make certain that in the future we have a standard that council is comfortable with and we know that we can present, you know, whenever it comes up. So basically, just in a little more detail, when staff has to go back to council and request an extension, there's a lot of time that gets involved in that, staff time, attorney time, other, you know, city staff, and there's a cost to doing that. So we want you to look at that, see if you can estimate that. And then in addition to that, there was direction to consider basically a daily penalty for missing it, and more of an incentive, in a sense, to have the developer of that, you know, master lease to basically get in gear and get the process going. Because again, every day there's a delay, there's actually a delay in income to the harbor. So I can answer any questions, you know, that you might have regarding this, but council is asking us to come back within about 90 days. So that would mean putting together an ad hoc committee, and whether it's next meeting or the meeting after, have some, you know, advice back to harbor staff so that we can go back and present to council in 90 days.
I have a couple initial questions, and I think a few people have some other ones. Is the scope of this to review the policy that's in place? I believe it was recently approved in 2020-ish.
So there is no policy directly related to that.
But this would be changed to the policy.
This would be advice to change.
Okay.
In addition to the policy. Not looking at the entire document. You don't need to go back and
just a specific area.
A specific issue. It's how do we look at that compensation for the time and that lost time of any, you know, daily delay.
And then the follow-on question to that, is there something that driving the using this to apply to a specific situation, or this would just be something ongoing?
This would then be something harbor staff could use anytime we have
to go forward
under extension request.
It's not a one-off.
It's a standard that we would then use.
Okay. Those are a couple of clarification questions I had. Open it up to council members. Kotowski?
Yeah, I had a question. Are you proposing as part of this that there's essentially an at-fault determination on whether the delays were due to the fault of the leaseholder or on, for example, city processes?
Right. So that, and that's a part of the process. That's why we need for you to vet all of that. There are issues with this. We recognize that there's issues in implementing this, so we want your advice on how to address all that.
I was just going to say that I don't have any further questions. I would put myself forward to volunteer as to chair the subcommittee.
Thank you. I was hoping you were going to say that.
My first question is, this Harbor Advisory Board for over 30 years now has had essentially no oversight powers over Tidelands Trust leaseholds. And I'm pretty heavily invested in the process on an individual basis, but do we feel that the board has the knowledge and experience right at this moment to weigh in properly on that issue, or might we benefit from a kind of Tidelands Trust lease study session as a future agenda item? I know they did a session that they presented to our board, sort of how the process works, and that was about 10 years ago.
And I can't answer that specifically. I would say that you do have representatives on your board who are leaseholders. They have knowledge of the process. They've been through it. So I would advise to possibly pick those who might have some specific knowledge related to that.
And the other question I had is sort of as phrased, it seems that the subcommittee is tasked with coming up with potential penalties, like fines, if you will, for consent of landlord exclusivity agreements that fail to meet certain deadlines. Is not one of the possibilities allowing that consent of landlord to expire and then allowing that leasehold to open up to the public, and then we might see some RFP boatyard proposals and some other alternatives?
And that's a good question. That's already in the policy now. That's already in consent of landowner now. So that I don't believe that's will change. There's always the option of a penalty or termination.
Thank you.
Thank you, Member Green. Any other questions, Jeff?
Okay. Yeah, the lost revenue that you're talking about, is that dealing with the 5 years previously to a lease expiring, where an attempt is made by a leaseholder to pursue his project?
No, this is relating directly to the consent of landowner time frame. So there's a specific time frame that's established once you've made a decision to work with a developer or a current master leaseholder.
And that should be done previously to 5 years where the lease is expiring.
Not necessarily. It really has to do with once a decision has been made to move forward with a project and whether that master leaseholder has been issued a consent of landowner.
So when exactly is the lost revenue occurred?
So when that consent of landowner time frame is established, part of that is the last date, which says the project's done, you're now open and operating, and based on that time frame, the harbor's expected a higher level of revenue based on the construction time.
Well, I'm a bit confused because I read the master lease side agreement, mm-hmm. and I see where within 5 years a landlord or leaseholder is to make his intent known and pursue it ahead.
Right.
But I didn't see a particular time when consent of landowner is required. Am I correct?
You're correct. That's a process that can take, you know, a short time or a long time. So it's really not related to that 5 year time frame at all. It's related to when the harbor and the master leaseholder have come to an agreement to move forward. Council has approved that this is the right master leaseholder to move forward with the project, and this is the time frame that's been established to, you know, come before planning committee, come before coastal, get sure. permits, get construction. Sure. Each of those has a time frame.
So during all that time, though, the existing leaseholder is already paying his revenue, his lease site fees to you.
Correct.
Okay. So when his lease site expires or a new lease site, if he fails to perform on his lease site after his lease expires, then either you can issue a month-to-month or a short-term lease. Is that correct?
Correct.
So I don't see where there's lost interest. I don't see where the lost revenue shows up.
So when the harbor negotiates with a master leaseholder to redevelop the property,
yes.
There's a time frame expected to when that property is going to open new. And there's a new lease that's in place, and that new lease generally is going to be market value.
Yes.
So the longer that takes, the more the harbor is losing the revenue.
Because you're based on the previous cost of the appraised value of the lease.
Well, the new master, let's say the new lease is going to be a completely different lease.
So that's where the lost revenue is at.
There's an expected opening date. That opening date doesn't happen because timelines are missed. It continues to get pushed out. So there's a loss of revenue.
I understand.
But in addition to that, my understanding through counsel and through the city attorney's office is that a penalty is justified in order to create incentive to move the process along as quick as possible.
So when does that penalty start? I mean, you just told me that there is no time required for you to do a master lease agreement, consent of landowner. So I'm just curious, when does that, you say, at some time? I don't understand when that penalty takes effect.
Every time a deadline is missed. So the consent of landowner has many deadlines. And I bet, Charisse, you've been through the process.
Yes, lots of times.
Yeah. So there's always a deadline, and when the deadline is missed, the consent of landowner technically terminates unless there's another provision to do something else. And the process has been to simply go back to council and request an extension. Council can say no, terminate, and that's where we are. Or with this process, they can say continue the process. However, this is the fee. And this is the penalty if you don't meet the new deadlines.
This consent of landowner form hasn't been really, what's the right word, applied a lot, at least since 2020. I know that it needs to be done, yeah. But a lot of times it's slipped through the cracks.
Yeah. Well, I can't address that. I don't know.
Okay.
But my direction from council is we're going to follow the current policy that was established in, was it 2020?
Yes.
And we're going to follow that, and that's my direction.
Okay.
Thank you, Member Dowdy. Hanson, I think you might have a comment or two.
I think 5-6 years that I've been on HAB now, and I was on the lease policy ad hoc committee, and as far as that committee goes, it was comprised of a lot of knowledgeable individuals from all different avenues of the community. We did a lot of research, a lot of time going and looking at all the different communities that are as close to us as possible, and at times I even went out to like Washington and didn't stay necessarily in California. And the master lease policy that was edited, it actually hasn't been implemented at all yet. And this particular situation, yeah, there wasn't a fee because there's so many things that are affiliated with why a timeline wouldn't be met. That is really hard to audit. with that being said, I would just hope that if we do create another ad hoc committee, that it is comprised of a multiple array of people within the community that will really look into all of those different issues, whether it be staff, redirection by different parts that staff hires, whether it be something completely out of the hands of the individuals, such as COVID and lack of workforce, weather. And so with that, I'd like to be a part of it if it isn't a conflict. Continue to be a part of the lease policy.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Any public comment on that particular topic? I think I heard two people that wanted to volunteer. Three people, Gene? Yeah. All right, perfect. So we've got the HAB committee. So, John, you like to?
No, we can't have
four. Yeah. No. I don't know who gets to be the decider here.
Gene, this would be one of those first.
Sean, would you be disappointed if it was Mary, Gene, and Charisse? Or?
I think that all three are qualified, but I am too.
Yeah.
I can step back. I think all three of you have more experience here.
You sure?
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Okay. And that makes that easier. Ted, is there anything that we're missing here for this? I think you've got three great volunteers for this.
No, I don't. No, I'm not a Browns Act expert. I don't know if a motion's needed. We were just kind of discussing that ourselves.
Last training, because that motions are more geared towards city council activities. So the takeaway that we got from the city lawyer was it was just mostly voice vote among us.
So I would just repeat again that the direction is to come back. My direction was to come back to council in 90 days, which would mean, hopefully 60 days.
Yeah.
You could have a recommendation.
Yeah,
we'll bring it back on the calendar in June.
Sure. We will have monthly updates going forward to try to keep it on track.
I'm going to swap myself back out for Mary if it does take place in July. I'm not sure if I can make the July or August meeting. So I just, for the sake of, if Mary wants back in, I'll back out. Based on my interest, but based on the timing.
Fair enough.
Can't even give it away.
All right, Mary, you back in?
I'm in. Put me in.
All right, so.
Cal, can you repeat who's on the?
Sure. Member Witowski, Member Hansen, and Member Dowdy.
And we don't have a meeting in July, just so you're aware. Yeah.
All right. With that, we can close item B1, I believe.
And do you want to do a public comment for that?
Anybody? Chuck, any public comment? Zara? No? Okay. You're welcome as well. All right. Thank you. That would close business item B1. We can move on to business item B2, which is departmental updates.
Chair Myers, committee members, I've got a fairly lengthy oral report to provide to you. I didn't have any opportunity the last month to do that. So I just want to let you know that my report is more about my actions, not generally harbor staff actions. What they're doing on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis goes on often without me, fortunately for me, they're able to hold things together. So this is in addition to what's done on a regular basis. But I did want to give you an update on the Washington trip. You had asked me to provide a little bit. That was back in end of February, early March. That was the CMANC meeting. The CMANC is the California Marine and Navigation Conference. Generally, it's a conference or it's an organization that supports harbors along the California coast and ensures that funding is available for us for dredging. That's their primary. So that meeting is held in D.C. It's done there because agencies are there. The Army Corps is there. We have the opportunity to bring them in. We are able to make a case for funding, even though we're generally going to be funded every year. The dollar amount can change dramatically depending upon, congressional funding on budgets. So we want to always stay in front. We want to stay engaged with them. It's important that they know who we are and they know what's going on here. So we did go there this year. Typically, the dredging request that we make in February is for the following year. So this year's dredge was funded last year. The request was last year, and this year's funding will go to next year's dredge. Because of that, we asked for, and I just got involved in the process and learned, not only do we do an annual dredge, but every 6 to 7 years we should be dredging further back in the channel. But honestly, I didn't learn that until I got here, and we were already on year 9, I think. I think it was 2015, so a year 7 or 8. I don't know that if it hadn't been requested, it certainly hadn't been funded. So we went with actually two requests. We went for next year's dredging, let's please dredge as we normally do, and then the following year, let's make certain the Army Corps requests funding to go all the way back in the channel. We were very pleased to learn that the Army Corps stepped up this year and provided funding for 2024 next year for the entire dredge. So we asked for $4 million. The Army Corps recommended $14.5 million, which is the largest amount that's been recommended for Morro Bay. So we're pleased to see that. The only concern I have is our permit, the environmental permit for dredging is a 6-year permit, and it expires this year, and they're in the middle of obtaining the next permit for next year, and anything can happen in that process, but let's just be hopeful that that goes smoothly. If that's the case, we're going to have a massive dredge next year and going back past the boat ramp at that time. While we were there, we met with our congressional leaders to ensure that funding was available. We met with Feinstein's aides. We met with Padilla's aide. We met with, actually, Congressman Carbajal and Panetta met directly with us, which we were very impressed with their office that they would be there and actually meet with us. So we made our requests there not only for dredging, but for additional funding for the North TDOC project. As you're probably aware, that project for repairs or refurbishment, I think, was pegged at about $3.8 million. Last year they asked for $3.8 and Congress awarded $1.5. So this year we went back and said, look, we're, you know, it hasn't changed. We need $2.3 million more. And we made that request to their office. We will know in about a week or two what their recommendations are with that. So we're hopeful to hear something positive regarding that. We also met with other agencies. We met with BOEM, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. Obviously, wind, you know, the wind farm issue is an issue, and we want to be engaged with them and kind of find out what we can. We met with HUD. HUD is actually the agency that funded the $1.5 million. Don't ask me why, but that's where the funding came from. This year, if we are awarded funds, it won't be from HUD. It'll be from a different agency, and we don't know where that will come from. But we also met with the Department of Transportation, because that's the agency that has been funding port infrastructures, and we wanted to address our opportunity to obtain funding through them. And they made it very clear to us that their, I guess, you know, emphasis is on transportation. So in order to obtain funding from the Department of Transportation, you need to have a transportation component to it, and that generally involves rails, trucks, some facility that transports goods throughout the U.S., and it's a hard case for us to make that we have that. I'd like to talk a little bit more about offshore wind. You know, obviously, we had that discussion with BOEM, and just for information, BOEM simply issues the permits. They approve the leases. They have a 5-year period right now where these conditional leases have to meet certain obligations. Once those leases are confirmed and signed, they're not the agency that's involved at that point. That will be an agency called BESI, Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement. That'll be the lead agency that those wind farms and possibly, you know, other agencies will be dealing with. We did have a visit, actually, 2 days ago with Senator Padilla's aides, who came directly to Morro Bay specifically to look at offshore wind. And I want to make it clear that our involvement with any of these agencies or any of these meetings is not an indication of support or not support. We need to be at the table. We need to know and hear what's going on because decisions are being made at a very high level, and we want to know what's happening before it happens. So we're going to stay engaged as much as we can, you know, with all the different agencies. There's another agency, which is a local organization called REACH. Jeremiah can probably talk, you know, regarding them and what they're doing. But that's another meeting that I'm going to attend regularly and listen to. Coming next month is a very large summit called the Pacific Offshore Wind Summit. I will be at the table. I believe Council Member Landrum is going to be there along with the mayor. And again, that's to gain knowledge and meet with representatives and find out as much as we can. I can tell you there's more questions than there ever are answers on this at this point. So that's the stage everyone is in. Talk a little bit about the goal process. As you know, yesterday, two of you were at the city's workshop, which was a goal planning workshop. A lot of it came out of that. Staff worked on it today and will be presenting back to council basically what council has directed staff to do. That's part of the reason why we've asked you to hold a little bit on your goal setting. I'm very appreciative that you did what you did a month ago because you were only one of two committees in the city that presented in advance what you thought was important to the harbor. So that was very important. That was presented to council, and that would have been used in that process. So at this point, really what happens is council will go through the process of establishing goals for the city. When that is complete, we're going to come back, and we're going to ask you again to reevaluate how your goals for the harbor can be in alignment with the city goals, because it's the city council goals that are driving policy for all of us. So that process will take place. But I do want to mention some of the things that I gleaned from that. And, you know, after I finish, if you have other comments, you know, please do that. But I was only writing down issues that came up from some of the general public. Commercial fishing industry was brought up as an issue. Keeping the waterfront master plan. I know we had a couple of comments on that. That made great headway, I believe, with council goals. Parking is another issue. The opportunity at the Rock was discussed. Other important, you know, stakeholder comments were maintaining the harbor, protecting our environment, growing the waterfront, importance of the Maritime Museum. Came up. I think that was very important. And there was a very interesting just comment by one person about a funding opportunity, and maybe this is something we'll ask you to look at some point in time, but it was that percentage charge, that optional percentage charge that one city has established that they talked about. What was the city? It was... do you remember? You weren't there. Oh, I'm sorry. It was somewhere in it was in Colorado. It was a ski town in Colorado where the businesses all agreed to put, whether it was a restaurant or a retail, an optional 1% charge if customers were willing to pay it that would go towards improvements. It was a
simple tip kind of concept.
So it was interesting. Anyway, I just wrote that down. So, you know, again, going back to the process for your committee, we're going to wait on council to approve the goals for the city. We'll come back, look at those goals, and readdress whether our goals that you've looked at are going to line up. We don't want to go outside of, you know, really their direction. We can't go against it. We want to, you know, basically complement it. It doesn't have to be exact, but it, at a minimum, it needs to complement what they've asked the city to do. Let's see here. I want to talk about some items that are being worked on that fall into play with some of the things you said were important, like infrastructure. So the harbor is working towards a DBW grant for the boat ramp replacement. I just want you to be aware of that. It's an ongoing process. We hope to submit in February and obtain funding. That process takes some time, but hopefully get the boat ramp repaired with grant funds. We are working towards the replacement of the Beach Street docks. It's a small segment of docks that has been designed at this point. Funding has been set aside for that, is something that I learned. So there is funds to replace those docks, so we're going to move forward with that project. As you are aware, Council approved $80,000 for emergency repairs. That should start soon. That's going to keep the boat ramp fingers open. It's going to keep, you know, a number of commercial fishing docks open. We are working on the insurance claim from the storms with FEMA. I mean, not with FEMA, but additionally with FEMA. That is a significant process that the city and the harbor has to go through in order to get funded. I will tell you, one of the things that came out of our meeting with Senator Padilla's aides, one of the aides is the contact to FEMA for our district. So he made it very clear that smaller agencies like Morro Bay, it's much more difficult for us to navigate that process. We just don't have the resources, and they've committed their support on anything we need to make that happen. So that was another reason why we need to be at the table with, you know, with these agencies. Revenue. We're going through our current budget process. Revenues are projected to be flat for this year. That's not our projection. That's a citywide projection from consultants who basically understand and know what's happening in the market. But I do want to mention one thing that we were able to achieve just recently, and I've heard it from you separately, and I've heard it from the community. You know, we are a tidelands, and what happens in the tidelands is supposed to stay in the tidelands, and we learned that event fees that occurred in the tidelands were not being paid to the harbor. And so that's just been an ongoing process. I don't think there was anything intentional about it. It's just one of those processes that gets set up. So we were receiving maybe $5,000 or $6,000 a year. And after meeting with city staff, city manager, finance, they've agreed to ensure that all fees for events that occur in the tidelands goes to us. So we estimate that to be about an additional $25,000. So we'll take every dollar that we can. So that's just a small way, you know, that we can get some money back. And again, in the current budget process, you know, I think if you haven't been, you'll hear more about the budget process and the city's projections. If you were there last night, I think you saw kind of what the, I guess, projections are for the next few years. It's not great. It's not anything to be, you know, completely scared about.
Keeps pace with inflation is or slightly below.
Yeah, so it's really hard to say. But as far as the harbor goes, we don't see much changes in our net income. So that's where we are. Public facilities, I believe I mentioned, if I didn't, well, I couldn't have mentioned at the last meeting because I think it came afterwards. One of the things that I've recognized in the harbor is that the office condition from an efficiency standpoint and from working isn't the best. And there's been a lot of there's a file full of different designs and and plans to make some changes to the office. We're going to do just a little bit of improvement. We had set aside about $35,000 approved by council to make some improvements inside the harbor office. We're hoping to not only make it better for staff, but to make it better for the general public that comes and visits, provide a little bit of meeting space, not much, but a little bit. And that's something we're going to work on pretty soon. And I may be coming back to you on another item that I may need help with, and I'll just quickly tell you what that is, and we can deal with it at a later time. But there's so many pictures in the harbor offices that really aren't appreciated because they're back in many of the different offices and some are out front. And I'm wondering, is there a way, I don't know if it's a maritime museum type opportunity, but some way to clean the harbor offices a little bit, but not lose that history of all of those great pictures that really go back a long, long time.
So. I like that picture that's in Eric's hole. Well, now your office, the whole picture.
Well, so there's some big ones there, too, that I'm, you know. But anyway, we'll address that, and I do think I'd like some direction on how we might handle something that. Parking. I think that's going to be an ongoing discussion with council. I think we're going to delve deeper into it. And then leaseholder relations. I've met with the Embarcadero Master Leaseholder Board, and then I met with their members. I think it's nice that there is a group. It may not be everyone, but it's at least a majority that can provide a single voice so we can hear kind of, you know, rather than hearing all the different decisions or opinions, it's nice to get one voice from an organization and say, this is kind of where we stand, this is our position. So I think that's great, and I'm looking forward to working with them. And, you know, from a leaseholder relations standpoint, I've had the opportunity, you know, to present to council in closed session, and it's very clear that the new, well, the 2 or 3 year old lease policy that's been established is going to be implemented, and my direction is to make certain that it's implemented. So that's what we're going to do. There's a lot of, right now we're in the middle of a lot of things that happened and need to move forward in some manner, and I'm not going to commit that everything is a perfect black and white from this point forward. There's always, you know, that process where you have to kind of look at it and go, well, that was already done. Is it really fair? But I can tell you, new decisions going forward is going to be the lease policy. So once we get through this gray period, it's going to be black and white. And then other, just so you know, the storm, the two additional storm events in March took tremendous staff time. There was a lot that occurred, not only from a safety, you know, the Harbor Patrol and their need to, you know, cruise the harbor and see what vessels were breaking loose or what moorings were, not tied properly. But a lot of staff time was directed towards that, and it was outside of not only our normal daily routine, but everything else that, you know, that we need to work on. So, and one other item, we've had an open position at the harbor for a part-time admin. We have hired a person, so you'll begin seeing someone. It's a part-time position, generally, you know, a number of hours per day. But from an efficiency standpoint of staff, it's going to help tremendously because not only does Lori handle everything that's going on the lease side, she answers phones, she handles customers at the counter, and it's very difficult to be, you know, effective and efficient in your job when you're interrupted on a daily basis. So we're really looking forward to that. And that's my presentation. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
I have a few, but we'll go ahead and start.
One of the things that you said is the study said that the economy is going to flatline. Is that, like, do you know, do they support, like, a percentage lower than the previous year or any kind of?
So from my recollection, the and I'm not sure who the city uses. I can't even address, you know, who that is. But there's expected to be approximately a 0.6 increase. So it's not a 0.6 increase of total sales versus last year. So that's considered to be a flat line, not a decline, but a slight increase.
Okay.
And actually kind of related to that, is it fair to say that an outside consultant is probably not factoring things like a soon to open redeveloped Leaf site and nuances like that. That's more of a market level thing.
Yeah. I think they're looking at, you know, general businesses that are open and the general economy, you know, as it relates to that. So yeah.
So looking at it from that perspective, flatlining with a little bit of an increase in last year, the budget that we had resulted in about $600,000 that we were able to use towards needed infrastructure or other things that we recommended. So do you feel like the budget is looking definitely in the black for 2023-24?
So when you say $600,000, that was not from ongoing annual operations. That would have been pulled some of that from Harbor Reserves. So Harbor Reserves are getting smaller and are not expected to necessarily grow this year.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Ted, very much for the presentation. And I was just curious, Ted, that I know or expect that FEMA monies will take a while to land here. Insurance, probably the same. So my question was, will there be an effort made? It's kind of a lot of waste of money, but will there be an effort made to repair the damaged docks before replacing them? What I mean by that is we've got a lot of broken dockage, just to make it clear to everybody, we've got a lot of broken dockage, and that those docks need to be replaced anyway.
Yeah.
But now, we won't have the money to replace them, so we'll have to hopefully patch them up and make do with, and then replace them as soon as we have the opportunity. Will they be getting repaired, I guess?
I think it's going to be a matter of funding. I have asked for a little bit of funds to continue some repairs. The money is just simply not there this next budget year to do a lot. It's a challenge. I mean, I don't know what else to say other than we're going to have to really prioritize what we have and what we need to spend it on to keep the docks operating. Because quite honestly, even if we wanted to replace the docks today, if we had the funds, you know, that's a multi-year process. So there's no question our strategy for the next few years is going to be to repair them until we can replace them.
Thanks.
Yep.
Thanks.
Any other questions before go ahead, Mary?
I just had one comment. I appreciate the very thorough update, and while I'm excited about consulting on the redecorating of the Harbor office, I would just continue to push you to look for ways that we can contribute to all the great stuff that you've kicked off. I'm really excited about the council kind of tapping us to look at the extension process for the leaseholder management policy. I think that's a great use for the HAB. I'm super excited about that. And I'm excited, like, we kicked off initial conversations regarding the launch ramp with DBW. I'd be happy to offer my services, and I know others would be definitely interested in helping with that grant process as you guys are going through that. So I appreciate the updates, and I just want to keep pushing you to look for ways that we can support in meaningful ways.
Thanks, Barry. It's my turn here. I just a couple questions during your overview. You talked about the $4.5 million that would be in 2024 to do the larger dredge.
$14.5 million.
Yeah, $14.5 million in 2024. How far south does that go? I mean, it goes like basically to the State Park Marina. Would that be included?
No, it would not go all the way back to the State Park Marina. I'm not certain how much further, several hundred yards past the boat ramp. I'm not sure the exact
Joe's
marker.
To German Joe's, the boat.
Yeah.
Or
haul out facility, boatyard. Okay.
What I can do, I think the Army Corps, when they renew their environmental permit, they provide it's almost like a bathymetric survey of what their permit allows for, and I think I can send that to you, and that'll show you what would be the extent. It's not what they do every year, but it's what they would do during that dredge, so I'll send that to you.
Thank you. Okay, that's the first question. The next question was about the T-pier, and you have a partial grant, a little less than half, 1.5 versus 3.8. Is there any opportunity to start work on, you know, do 1.5 million now and 2.3 later? Or does it make sense to do it all at once?
Well, that's, you know, a decision we're trying to make. I think at a minimum we need to wait to hear what's going to be recommended. What's recommended doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be approved. You have to wait until the budget is approved. You know, we've had that discussion. I think in any case, we have to scope what 1.5 will do, and we have to scope what 3.8 will do, and then determine what we can do based on whether we know what the funding is.
Okay, and you said the original part wasn't budgeted yet, the 1.5?
The 1.5 has been approved.
Okay.
That's an approved fund. That's a HUD appropriation. I'm
not going to argue that one. Okay, thank you. And then the last question, you mentioned about event fees and that you got some money this year and expect more in the future. I know the upcoming Ironman this May, will that have any positive impact on you collecting event fees from that?
So Ironman is... I'll address Ironman.
It was just a question. If you don't have the answer, yeah, TBD.
Ironman's a three-year contract with the city. City-sponsored event. I'm not 100% certain that there's a event fee that's paid. We'll look into it.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Thank you. That's the last of my questions. Anything going once, going twice? All right. That closes out business item B2. The next three topics on here are the existing ad hoc committees. I imagine they're probably go pretty quick because we've kind of been in a holding pattern. I'll start off with the parking committee. I don't know, don't have much to say. We've been in a holding pattern. We've made some over the last 2 months, some efforts to get some suggestions into the city council. Because there's so much other elements involved in parking beyond just the Embarcadero. The last sort of feedback that we got from city staff basically was to, you know, let's look at it from a citywide level with the Embarcadero being one piece of that. So we're still kind of in standby. Been a few sort of independent efforts beyond that. I don't know, Hanson or Vail, if you have any other comments on that?
No.
Nope.
I know that the study, there's a new part of the study that they brought into the staff, correct, from Walker, that we hasn't been released to the ad hoc committee yet?
And I'm trying to remember, there's been so many iterations that have been passed along. I don't know if I've seen the latest. I should have seen it.
There was one report that was made public probably last year in 2022, and there was a follow-up.
Okay. And so what I've seen would have been in addition to that.
Yeah, there was a second study that hadn't been publicly or hadn't been released beyond city staff.
Right.
At the meeting last night, I just was told that there was a new update, and it was received. So I'm hoping that in the next month we'll be able to get together and review that and have a meeting, because they tried to schedule a meeting and then canceled it prior to its release.
Yeah, and I'm not, you know, leading that process, so I don't know exactly how that's going to
play. So hopefully we'll come back with
Yeah, well, we have
more
to have a city council representative nearby. So,
can I add something about parking? This sort of goes back to the council's closed session meeting on April 11th. One of the projects that's being discussed is the Market Plaza potential sale, and different iterations of that sale have included the public parking locations on Market Street above D'Estacio's and the large public parking lot below D'Estacio's along Embarcadero. So if folks feel strongly one way or the other about retaining that public parking, April 11th is a good opportunity to chime in.
All right, thank you. Any other questions or comments? All right, move on to item B4. I think this will go even quicker. This is the Marine Services. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Any public comment? Thank you for that reminder. Just kind of motoring through it. Nope. All right. Now, moving on to Marine Services.
I have nothing new for Marine Services, mostly because it's been wintertime and we've all been hunkered down. I would remind that in the last several meetings, we've had boaters' concerns expressed here, and without debate, they are real concerns, and I agree with the boating public, and perhaps we'll widen our scope to talk about that some more. Thanks. Or any questions?
Thank you, Member Bell. Any other questions or comments? Open that up to public comment. Check. Did your piece at the beginning? Moving on to the finance and budget ad hoc. I'll look to either member Green or Skoutsky. Go ahead, Mary.
Yeah, we didn't formally meet. I think we're offline put together the SMART goals to recommend for each of our proposed goals, which we have, but I think aren't going to discuss. So in the holding pattern, as you mentioned.
I mean, I do have one comment. I did discuss with the Harvard director that some of the budgeting and finance we should probably start to pick up again. So we're looking at maybe a mid to late April or later April to go revisit some of that. That's acceptable. And we talked about it before. The budget problems that we talked about a year ago are still kind of there.
And this is an existing ad hoc?
This is existing. Yeah, it's been in place for since I've been here and even prior to my starting, if I'm not mistaken.
I'll just mention that as far as these groups that were created last year, you are free to ask how some things that you're concerned about can fit into them. So budget doesn't necessarily mean the balancing of the Harbor Department budget. It means revenue-seeking areas and opportunities, grants. There's a multitude of things that can fall under the umbrella of the finance committee. So think outside the box if it's something that you want to work on. I know you guys are all really knowledgeable and ready to do some work. I'm not on the budget committee, but I just advise that you guys have a big scope of work that you can include.
Thank you. Actually, that reminds me of one of the goals that made at least the initial cut from the city council was a grant writer, and it's something that we've recommended on the budget committee many times. So we're very excited that, at least I am personally, and I think Sean and Mary would share that's something that should make the cut, hopefully. The recommendations we've had, and it'd be citywide, not just the harbor. Any public comment on the budget? Yes, sir, come up to the mic.
As part of looking into this shipyard stuff, I actually looked at every boat storage facility in a harbor from Monterey to the Mexican border to see how people were storing boats and how big shipyards were and things. And based on that, we have a small boat storage yard here, and I guess you guys call it the Triangle area. And based on how other places have laid out their boat storage yards, we could increase
the number of boats stored in that area from anywhere to up to around 65, 70 boats or up to a little over 90 boats. And it's not a lot of money, you know, but you're talking another anywhere from 4,000 or 5,000 to 7,000, 8,000 a month that could come in just by relocating how the boats are stored. I sat there and looked at it, and it looks like everywhere up and down the coast, pretty much, the spaces are 9 to 10 feet wide, and they're set at a 45 degree angle along the longest property lines. And they come out about 30 feet, and a row of two sets is about 70 feet wide. And it, with just a simple restriping out there, we could get a lot more boats stored. I understand there's a waiting list. So not a lot of money, but, hey, a few dollars here and a few dollars there, and you might have some big money. There is one issue, and that's there's those power lines that come across from the Maritime Museum, and I think they go back to some wildlife center. For boats with masts up, those would have to get either underground or moved to along the edges. I had a friend from the yacht club tell me at one time there was that had been looked into, and it was going to cost like $10,000-$12,000 for PG&E to move those power lines so they didn't have a problem with mast up. But you know, I'm retired, and sometimes I just look at stuff, and that was just one thing. I did a whole bunch of drawings of different possible layouts in that triangle area that I'd be happy to share if somebody'd want to look at them.
Yeah, any homework that anyone does for us, send it to us so we can pass it along.
How do I send it to you?
There's the city website. We have an email address, have@morrobayca.gov.
Okay, just send that in or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah, you can communicate. If you send it in advance, we can actually have it as agenda correspondence as part of the meeting as well.
Ah, okay.
But it will go to all 7 or 8 of us and some staff.
Then I'll send that out, because one of the drawings is just in the area that's currently in the fence.
Mm-hmm.
Oops, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Yeah. We'll
yeah.
And then another drawings look at the whole area and still trying to leave a significant parking for the Maritime Museum. But I also understand that the Maritime Museum has recently got an extension of their property, which I would have to take into consideration and change some things.
Yeah.
But I'll email it off.
Absolutely. We appreciate that.
Yeah.
The Triangle Lot has quite a history over the last couple decades.
But, you know, I've looked on Google Earth going back as far as it'll go,
mm-hmm.
and it looks like that property has always been used as a little bit of boat storage. And I don't know who's sticking the boats in there, but there's not very many.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what's been there for a long time.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Question?
Yeah, I was just wondering, did you, the drawing that you did stay within the confines of the chain link fence, or did you use the whole triangle, the whole back part of the triangle lot?
I have one drawing that stays within the chain link fence that's there, and I think that drawing came up with about a total of 65 spaces, okay? And then I understand if you go what I call that way, thinking of the thing behind us, you know, there's an area that's not within the chain link fence, and I've been told that that parking area is somehow reserved for Native American Indians or something.
That's correct. So there's a small treed area.
Yeah,
with rocks around it. And that is designated area for the Salinans.
Okay. But does that include the parking area that goes from that treed area up to the chain link fence?
I can't answer that.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah, I don't know if that's been given a designation or not.
Yeah. And then the other drawing, and I did it before I heard about the Maritime Museum getting extended along there. I believe that had about 95 or 96 potential parking spaces for boats, you know, but that would change because of the areas and all that. And that still left a big area for parking around the Maritime Museum. But anyway, I'll send those off to you folks.
All right.
Not a lot of money, but, you know,
yeah,
a little
every dollar
extra.
Counts out.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. I think that ends public comment for budget or agenda item B5. And then we'll come to the last piece, B6, outreach. I guess we'll start over on this side this time. Any outreach, Member Matowski?
Nothing to report.
Couple items to report. Cal Poly graduation is much later than usual. It's like June 17th. So a lot of people, some people consider Memorial Day sort of the start of the summer. Some people consider Cal Poly graduation. It's a little bit later into the year, something for some businesses to possibly factor in. And then regarding planning at the city level, some items that the Planning Commission is working on or planning staff. There has been pretty much every meeting if you've been tuning into Planning Commission, pretty much every meeting over the last couple months, they've brought in some members of the public that have some knowledge of Morro Bay history or history in general, each one of those sessions has been really entertaining, informative. We've had locals going back to the 40s, talking about their grandparents, even beyond that, and referencing old waterfront buildings and what used to be in them and whatnot. Anyway, that's building towards what might eventually be a historical preservation ordinance that gets brought forward at the Planning Commission level and then eventually council if that moves forward. Planning Commission also made a recent pledge to revisit the ad hoc committee that is focused on streamlining the planning review process. So I think that is music to some people's ears. At a fairly recent Planning Commission meeting, and it will probably come up again in the near future, is an increased emphasis on waterfront projects going through concept review, I believe you go through concept review. I think did your project go through concept review? Do you remember? What was it, like a formal concept review Planning Commission meeting?
Yes.
Okay. So concept review is not necessarily a formal hearing where a project gets approved or denied, but concept review has been available to developers, and it's going to be encouraged for waterfront projects in order to prepare that project for more likely approval at the official Planning Commission hearing. So the intent, I don't believe, is to add any barriers or extra levels of planning review, but to instead streamline that planning review process. So concept review may be more prominent, I guess, maybe one way to say that. So those are some things that the Planning Commission is currently working on with planning staff. Thank you.
Thank you, Member Green. Member Powell?
My outreach activities have been, to a large extent, as a result of the Morro Bay Maritime Museum. They have wisely or unwisely elected me vice president of operations for this next year. And so from here on out, I'm just going to, every time we have a meeting, I'm going to say, yes, I've been working down at the Maritime Museum. We get, you know, thousands of people down there. That's my outreach. Thanks.
Thank you. Member Hansen?
Okay, so as maybe some of you have noticed in the back of our agenda for drawings, this was part of our outreach with the Del Mar School. We had the fifth grade class. There were three classes, and we went there with two representatives from the Harbor Patrol and gave them about a 15-20 minute demonstration about boat safety, and then we left them with guidelines to create a boating safety picture that would be put on a poster that would be put around town, and then our third place winner would get gift certificates to a couple of local Tidelands property businesses. The second place winner will get a trip on the harbor boat with four people for about 30, 45 hour, depends. Well, yep, from the harbor crew. And then the first place prize will go to on the Endeavor, two people for a half-day charter fishing trip. And so we gave them a deadline, and they got back to us, and I was really glad to see that we got quite a few submittals. And I want to tell you the four contestants that won. So right here we have in fourth place is Adrian Arroyo, and it's not as noticeable, but the top four all got points because they really listened to what we talked about during the demonstration, and they had elements of boat safety within their drawing. And then on third place, we have Brady Flood. He has the rock, which we were all drawn to, And then he has at least three boating elements in his photo as well. And then we have second place, Dean Thompson, and he had quite a few descriptive writing about safety elements that are important when boating. And he has a shark, which that's pretty awesome. And then first place, we have Christian Osorio Gomez, and he has like the most elements of surprise and what you need to watch out for and be safe with and be prepared for. So they are all going to be on a poster that we can go around. Can we get that? Yeah, that would be great. This is just the rough draft right now. It's been pretty busy on the Embarcadero, so I had only limited time to put this together, but it's going to be something along these lines. And the cool thing that it talks about is that it's a boating safety week, and on Sunday, because Ironman is on Saturday, so we swapped it to Sunday, the 28th, and I also talked to the individual that gets donations for Life Fest. So if you bring in one of your old Life Fests, you can get a brand new Life Fest, a really good quality one. And these will be put around town. So thank you so much, Del Mar fifth graders. You did a great job. Thank you.
Charisse, the date is May 28th.
Ah.
Isn't the week before that, the 21st, the weekend of the 21st?
Oh, is it Sunday? It's Sunday the
21st. Yeah, I wouldn't.
So Sunday the 21st?
The 21st is Saturday.
This is why it's not completed yet.
Yeah, I would say that's just a rough draft. Yeah, that date doesn't.
So
the 22nd would be Sunday.
May the 21st.
Saturday.
Am I in 23? I'm getting the 21st.
Ironman is the 20th.
Okay, good. Okay, so I will switch that. We don't want to commemorate that one. We'll switch that before we put it around town. So Sunday, May 21st, come on down. There's going to be quite a few people doing demonstrations. There will be a bunch of different types of patrol boats that are out on the dock in front of the harbor.
All right. Well, remember, Brian, that's going to be a hard one to top. But any outreach? Did you want to come?
Yeah, for my outreach, I was able to take a class, Cal Poly. Marine science class out around the waterfront. And that's something you probably know that I do all the time. And They usually have each professor usually has a theme he wants to work on that day, but it's generally based around machinery or fishing elements such as gear types and vessel types and species types, that type of thing. So I did get to take one class out a couple of weeks ago. I've got another one in 2 weeks, and one of the professors there told me he'd have three coming up for next year, so next school year. Anyways, that's my outreach.
All right. Thank you, Member O'Brien. Member Dowdy?
Yes, my outreach has to do with commercial sport fishing, and because of the basically, there hasn't been much sport fishing yet. Rock cod is closed. Salmon's closed. So that's been pretty well shut down for a while. Little burial seas, that's about it. As far as mariculture in the back bay, because of all the storm damage, there's been a lot of silt in the back bay. So they're trying to work through all that. But I will follow up on Jeremiah's. With a hint, when you see all the kids down, let's say like Tideland Dock or in front of the harbor office, and they're over looking at all the kind of little stuff down there, and the eelgrass will go by. I'll happen to go by in the skiff and say, watch out for the sea snakes. They look just like eelgrass. They're long and skinny and green and brown. And they all go, oh, no, no, no. Of course, there are no sea snakes in Morro Bay.
Remember that one. Thank you, Member Dowdy. For this last month, most of my outreach was focused on the goals. We did, you guys did some homework on that, and we've had a little bit of change in direction, so that work won't be lost. It may be a little delayed, but I think with the timing of it, as the harbor director said earlier, I think we'll get our opportunity to work on some of this stuff more, and it'll start to trickle in over the next few months. I'm pretty excited about that. A little disappointed at first, but we're over that. And then again, the city goal meeting was well participated by the public, so it was super exciting and pretty energized. It's just, nothing happens fast by design. So with that, any public comment on we really forgot to give that to there. That closes the outreach and public comment. Now, any future agenda items that we want to put on for next meeting? All right. I think the meeting is adjourned. Oh, sorry.
Should we put, reviewing or discussing the proposal for the lease management policy consent of landowner on the next meeting to at least discuss or provide an update on?
Yeah, I guess it's...
Can we talk, the week before or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah. I'd like to see, it'll be on the agenda if it's short update. But yeah, thank you for that. All right. Very good.
All right.
See you next month.
Yeah.